Jewish audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Moshe New, rabbi at the Montreal Torah Center in Montreal, Canada.
It's the story of the crossing of the Red Sea, the conclusion of the Exodus. So, this is the seventh day after the Exodus, which is why Passover is for 7 days. Why is Passover 7 days? Because you argue, if you go through all that trouble for one day, you know, let's get our money's worth and at least have 7 days. That's not the reason. I mean, the trouble of koshering the house. No. It's 7 days because it's a 7 day event. The first day of Pesach, we observe the actual Exodus, the departure from Egypt. And the seventh day of Pesach is also a Yom Tov. First and last days are Yom Tov, because the seventh day is when they crossed the Sea of Reeds, or the Red Sea. And that was really the climactic conclusion of the Exodus. And the middle days are intermediate days, semi-Yom Tov. In Israel, there's 7 days, one day at the beginning, one day at the end, and 5 days in between. Here we always have two, but that's another story. So this is the story. This is the story of the seventh day, the crossing of the Red Sea. And we just read that the Jews are trapped between a rock and a hard place. That's how it goes. The sea in front of them and the Egyptians behind them. And finally Moses says to them, don't be afraid. Stand firm and you will see what God will do to rescue you today. You might be seeing the Egyptians today, but you'll never see them again. God will fight for you, but you must remain silent. Our sages tell us that at this critical juncture, the Jews broke up into four groups, four camps. What do we do now? What do we do now? Dear, dear. You know, seas in front of us, the mighty Egyptian armies behind us, and incidentally, you might ask a question. You might ask a question. Pharaoh's officers, led by Pharaoh himself, no less, are chasing them on chariots led by horses. Yes, yeah, so where'd they get horses from? Weren't all their animals killed in the plague of hail? As you remember too, that Moses had said that the ones that fear God should take their animals inside. So where these horses come from? The God-fearing Egyptians. And now they're pursuing them to bring them back or slaughter them. And they're the good ones. Yeah. So they were a tough lot, the Egyptians. They were a tough bunch. Even the good guys, you know, had a ways to go. So what do we do now? What do we do now? So they break up into four camps. 600,000 Jews, actually several million Jews, only four opinions. Four main opinions. Within each opinion there were many nuances, I'm sure. But four general groups. Group number one advocated mass suicide. Into the water. Drown. Rather drown than become slaves again or die here and give them the pleasure of having slaughtered the Jews. This is the Masada thing. Yeah. They'll die with dignity. They'll die with their own hands, thank you very much. And the sea's in front of them, there's no time. And they didn't even want the Egyptians to be able to gloat over their dead bodies or their spoils. So, into the water. Into the sea. That's one group. A second group advocated going back. Better a dead slave than being free. Better a slave and alive than free and dead. So we have no choice. We've got to go back. You know, it's good while it lasted. It was a pretty good attempt. We almost made it, but it was fun while it lasted. It's time to go back. 210 years of slavery, we're used to this anyway. They didn't know any other way. So it's back to Egypt. A third group said, no way. We'll fight. We'll fight to the finish. We win, we lose, we'll fight. We're going to go down fighting, if that's what it takes. And a fourth group said, you guys are all wrong. We've got to pray. God should save us. Now, as it happens, they were all in error. And to each one of them, each one of them was rejected by Moses. And his rejection to each group, each individual group, is conveyed in verses 13 and 14. And we'll hit the pause button, and I want you to tell me. Hello? Good. So, Moses addresses the four groups as follows. Don't be afraid. It's addressed to all of them. That's clearly an introduction, because the verse breaks it up with, replied Moses to the people. It doesn't say, Moses said to the people, don't be afraid. It's, don't be afraid, replied Moses to the people. That's an intro. Now, what do you do? So to the group that advocated into the sea, he says, stand firm. Don't proceed further. And you will see what God will do to rescue you today. The second group that said, advocated what? Returning to Egypt. Moses says, quote, you might be seeing the Egyptians today, but you will never see them again. So forget about going back to Egypt. Not happening. And to the group that says, let's fight, God will fight for you. And finally, to the group that says, let's pray, he says, you must remain silent. So then what are they to do? What are they to do? Verse 15. God says to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Speak to the Israelites and tell them to start moving. Just keep on going. A sea, raise your staff and the sea will split. You've got to keep on going, that's all. Who said stop? We're on the way to the promised land. Actually, no, they're on the way to Sinai to receive the Torah, and from there to the promised land. It's one journey. Did you ever hear a commandment stop? No. So stop this. Stop all this philosophizing. Just keep on going. That's the answer. Okay, now I've got a little question. Clear? Question. I told you that the words don't be afraid were addressed to all of them. In the four groups advocated to you, who's afraid? What was the indication that they're afraid in the four groups? The guys that are fighting are afraid. I mean, where's? No, say who said they're afraid? Why they're going back? Why they're afraid? The Egyptians don't want to kill them. They want to bring them back as slaves. Who's that? Which group is that? The ones. The ones who don't or do. So what are they afraid of? They go back. They're going to die if they surrender. They'll go back and finish. Wait, what's the fear? That group, who said they're afraid? The only one who could possibly argue was afraid is the ones that are going to commit suicide. I don't know, in Masada they were afraid. I think they were afraid. This is a noble death. We're not going to... Where's the elements of fear? In the four groups that I told you, where is their fear? We all die at our own hand rather than that leaves Nazi... Okay, Egyptian... Those, you know what I want to say. I'm not going to say it. It's on tape. You know, get the better of us. Where's fear? In these, and praying, afraid, if they're davening, then surely the people of faith are not afraid.
All of them must be
But I'm asking you, where is the fear? In the four groups that I told you, it's not intrinsic to their positions is fear. Huh? He was afraid. He certainly wasn't afraid. And he's talking to them. We'll leave that question for a moment. Don't be afraid. The group that prays is afraid. I mean, they're certainly not afraid. Praying to God, God should save us. Huh? Yeah, and I would think that the fighters weren't afraid either. No. Why are they afraid? So why is he saying, don't be scared? Who said they're scared? Where did Moses, how did he see, my question is, in what they were advocating fear? Where did he see fear? Okay. Because he does address it to all of them. It's clear from the verse, because it precedes the reply of Moses to the people. The verse breaks it up. He says, don't be afraid. The verse doesn't say, replied Moses to the people, don't be afraid, stand firm. Then you'd put it with the stand firm or something. Don't be afraid comes on its own, clearly addressing all of them. Why? Why is he saying that? Who said they were scared? Maybe it was, came very frightened. That's verse 9. I'm just trying to find the Hebrew there. One second. But in from the four groups that I told you, where do you see fear there? That's my question. Afraid of Moses' leadership? Doesn't sound like that's the problem. Doesn't sound like it. Well, we'll see presently. But first, we're going to explain this in the light of Hasidus. In other words, we're going to explain the eternal relevance and message of this narrative to us now. Right? That's what Hasidus does. Hasidus reveals the inner dimension of the narrative, of the law, of the story, as it applies to all people at all times. And this is the inside story now. What's going on here? Beyond now, I'm going now beyond what happened 3,317 years ago at the banks of the Red Sea. We're going to talk about this now on a transcendent spiritual level. Okay? This is what the verse is talking about. Egypt is in pursuit. Egypt is threatening the Jew. What's Egypt? Egypt's the world. The whole kit and caboodle. The word for Egypt in Hebrew is Mitzrayim. The root of the word Mitzrayim is Meitzar. Tzora. Sorrowful place. More accurately, a narrow place. This world is a narrow place. Why is it a narrow place? Because it's a very narrow-minded place. This world is a condition where you only see the here and now. And that's as narrow as you can get. Because God is eternal, and truth is infinite. And this world is a finite, limited, constricting, oppressive, condition. The body is that. The body is a micro of the world. The soul comes into a body, comes into a prison. A prison. The soul prior to its descent is a free, free godly spirit that has no limits, and now it's thrust into this body. It can only relate to reality now via the five senses and this physical apparatus, and it's highly limiting. I've often said that death is far more a shock for the dead than for the living. Death is far greater a shock for the one that dies, is what I'm saying, than for the living. Because a minute ago, I was seeing everything through the prism, or prison, I should say, of this physical, the brain, the eyes, and senses. And all of a sudden, I'm thrust out of this. And all of a sudden, truth, clarity, very shocking. But we forget. You know, 70, 80, 120 years, you get used to it. In fact, we get so used to it, we're reluctant to leave. We don't want to leave. We kind of like it. That's the biggest problem. We consider, you know, our physical life to be reality. It's like the story of Hasidim who are once farbrenging, now having a farbrenging with Shabbos. So on Shabbos you can't kindle a light, so it was getting dark. Well, no, it may have been still light, but the point was they'd ran out of l'chaim. So they sent one of the guys down to the basement to get a bottle. He says, but it's dark down there. I can't see anything. You couldn't take a light. So someone says, well, just wait a little while, and then you'll get acclimatized, and you'll be able to see. And the third said, and that's the whole problem. We think that darkness is light. We get used to it, and this is reality. And then we don't want to leave. So the soul's in a prison. And the soul and the world is a prison. The world threatens us at every turn. So what are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about the world? So one ideology, one philosophy is, what are we going to do about the world? We're going to ignore it. We're going to create our own spiritual enclave. We're going to isolate ourselves and insulate ourselves. We're going to build walls. And we're going to protect ourselves and live in this bubble. We're going to live in a place where we deliberately shut the world out. Yeah, because any exposure to the world is dangerous. Another way of describing this philosophy would be the body imprisons the soul. We'll leave the body behind. We'll meditate, we'll fast, we won't indulge it. We'll just enter into another space. That's kind of the same thing on another level. But what this philosophy is saying is, the world is a threat, it's an Egypt, so what's the answer? You run away from it. And that is a big accomplishment, to be able to be in the world and not in the world. To be able to create a haven, a spiritual haven, that's a big accomplishment. That success, says Group A. If we are to survive as Jews, if we are to maintain our spiritual integrity, we have to divorce ourselves from what's going on out there. We've got to create our own little environment. That's the only way we're going to survive. That's the group that says, cast yourself into the sea. The sea is always symbolic of the world of spirituality. The sea is a teeming world of life, but lost on the casual observer. And therefore it's symbolic of the spiritual reality which we're unaware of. So this group advocates, let's enter into the spiritual space, submerged in it. Surrounded, breathe it, surrounded by it. And we'll be untouchable that way. No one's going to venture here. Nobody wants this. That's the first group. And Moses says, no. So then the second group pipes up. You mean we shouldn't isolate and insulate? Okay. So they take the opposite position. If we're going to survive, we have no choice. We've got to be part of the scene. It's back to Egypt. We're in Egypt. When in Rome, there was Romans. We'll try and hang on to tradition as much as we can, but the reality of life's got to dictate our lives. The kids got to make a living, so you got to send them to non-Jewish schools. They used to think that, you know, our parents and grandparents, that we'll never survive if we send the kids to yeshiva. That's changing today a little bit, but or to a large degree. But it used to be the idea, look, in the old country we could do it, we can't do it here. This is a new Egypt, it's a new world. We're not in the shtetl anymore. We're going to survive in Canada or America or Australia or where have you. We're going to have to conform. We're going to have to adapt. Can't isolate. It doesn't work. They'll come and tear those walls down. So let's just blend in. And hang on as much as possible to our Jewish values. But the reality is what it is. What can you do? What can you do? We wring our hands and we say, this is, we've got to survive. Better, you know, dead than, I'm sorry, better a live slave than a free. Yeah. So that's the second group. Back to Egypt. Back you go. And Moses shakes his head in disapproval. So now what then? A third group. So it's not isolate, it's not conform. So we'll fight the world. JDL, yeah, that's an extreme example of that, but it's the Bible thumping. It's saying this. This is what it says. Fight the world means we're going to point out the ills of this world to our young and to the whole world and talk about heaven all the time and the rewards and the hellfires and the punishment, and we're going to marginalize the world and we're going to expose it. We're going to fight it. We're going to show its evils and never stop talking about it. And talk about the great reward that awaits us in the world to come. That's the Musar movement, if you wanted to know. It's a movement within Judaism. I'm sure as I was speaking earlier, you identified the first group. There are movements in Judaism that create their own, literally, their own villages, their own cities. And you want to come, fine, but they won't venture out unless they absolutely have to. Because the theory or the philosophy is you couldn't survive in an open society. It's an Egypt out there. Right? That's the first group. And we all know the conformist group. And then there's the fight you group. We'll fight the world. We'll point out its depravity. We'll expose it. We'll talk about the consequence of sin, the punishment, the tortures that await the soul if we indulge. And the reward if we do the mitzvahs. So what do you think about that group? What did Moses say to that one? No. So what's left? The fourth group. We haven't even talked about it yet. Yeah, what's wrong with the second and the first? They didn't make a lot of sense. But let's move on. I'll address why they're all wrong. The fourth group says, listening to what's been going on, it's not isolate and it's not conform, it's not adapt, it's not fight. So then what's left, argues the remaining Jews. So you pray to God. I mean, it's His world, let Him heal it. That's what God wants us to do. Don't engage it in the same way the second group does. Don't run away like the first. And don't be confrontationalist like the third. Turn to God that He heal it. He fix it. Pray for the Messiah. That's what we ought to do. Pray for the Messiah. Pray for redemption. Pray for an end to the Egypts of the world. And Moses says, no. No. And he prefaces it all by saying, what? Don't be afraid. And that's the key. Because what runs through all four groups is the notion that the world is the enemy. The world's the enemy. So what do you do with an enemy? Either you run away, you surrender, you fight, or you turn to the neighborhood, whatever, cop, mother, father, to help you, to intervene. Intervention. Let's try and summarize these in one word. First one would be isolate. Second one, well, it leads to assimilation, that's true, but they wouldn't say let's assimilate. It's conform. One word I want. One word. Confirm. Conform. The third, confront. And the fourth, pray, which means, well, it means call upon intervention. Intervention, that's the word. Divine intervention. And what's common to all four groups is the world's the enemy. And Moses says, no, it's not. Do what you have to do. Who told you to stop? Just keep the mitzvahs. Keep on going to Sinai. And you will see that the sea will split. That the world ultimately will applaud it, relate to it, and ask for more. That's the answer. And it all begins with, don't be afraid. Ultimately, heaven is going to come down to earth. This is the divine intention. It's here. There's godliness within. Our job is to uncover it, like the water covers the sea bed. All we have to do is uncover the godliness within. And how do you do that? By doing what you have to do. Do your mitzvahs. God says you've got to keep Shabbos. So what are you telling me? You make a whole calculation, a philosophy. You can't do it unless I live in a totally Jewish environment. That's group A. Group B is maybe Friday night, but Saturday I've got to be in the store. Group C says what? Yeah, throw rocks at the guys that transgress the Sabbath. And group 4 says, listen, I can't work Sabbath, pray to God for manna from heaven. Quits the job, whatever, you provide. Moses says, no. You just don't work on Shabbos. You explain that to your boss. Or if you're in charge, you certainly make that decision. And guess what? It'll be okay. It'll be okay. Do what you got to do. Keep on going. That's the message. Level one. Little story, you know, we always read this Torah portion, of course, this time of year. This time of year is always around the 10th of Shvat. The 10th of Shvat, as you know now, is the anniversary of the passing of the previous Rebbe, and the day when, therefore, the Rebbe assumed the leadership of Chabad Lubavitch. 10th of Shvat, 1950, is when that happened. So there's a famous story that I heard from the one to whom it happened. You see, for the first year, from 1950 to 1951, the Rebbe refused to accept the mantle of leadership. Once he said he's going to run away, I'll never find him. And he kept on arguing also that he did not receive any direct instructions from his father-in-law that he should assume the leadership, which is altogether very strange. I mean, why didn't the previous Rebbe leave a will? There were two sons-in-law, the Rebbe, the youngest son-in-law, and the oldest son-in-law. So normally it's the older son-in-law. But everybody wanted the younger son-in-law. The older son-in-law wanted to be, in fact. But soon after, he abandoned that idea and became a very devoted chassid of the Rebbe. But why didn't the previous Rebbe just make it clear in a will? Maybe I'll address that in a minute. But anyway, let me tell you the story. So the Rebbe said that he never got instructions. And the chassidim kept on persisting, and towards the end of the first year, letters came from all over the world, signed by the Hasidim in those communities in Israel, in Paris, Australia, London, where they begged the Rebbe to become leader and promised and pledged that they'd be faithful students. Anyway, so the Rebbe kept on saying that he didn't even got instructions. So one of the elder Hasidim of the day, Rabbi Kazanovsky, had a dream. He had this dream 3 nights in a row. He dreamt that he was sitting at a table, the previous Rebbe's table, exactly as it was. The previous Rebbe sat at the head of the table, the Rebbe to his left. And the previous Rebbe turns to the Rebbe and he says, why are you calling out to me? Why do you keep on saying, you know, referring to me? Speak to the children of Israel. This verse he quoted in the dream. Be so, and let them go forward. Speak Hasidus to them, speak Torah, and journey forward, and they'll become lichtiker and lichtiker, more bright and more bright. Anyway, he conveyed that letter, that dream to the Rebbe. I heard that the Rebbe thanked him for the dream, for conveying it. I'm not sure about that detail, but this is certain, that the next day after he told him these dreams that he had. He had came to 770, and the Rebbe sees him and says, ah, the dreamer has come. He's quoting also from the story of Joseph, who was called the dreamer. Anyway, apparently that story had a strong impact. Why am I sharing it with you? Because what I just shared with you now, the understanding of the four groups and what God's instruction is, I'm sharing with you that which the Rebbe had, how he explained the story. And this is so typical of his leadership. The world is not the enemy. Light up. And when does he assume the leadership in the parsha that this is read? But now we're going to go deeper. Because the truth of the matter is on a deeper level, and you see the endless, infinite layers to Torah. These four groups are all virtuous and positive. We're now going to go to another level. Let's not be confused. We explained it now on a pretty deep level too. I'm sure you'll agree. But we explained each group as being in error. But on a deeper level, they're conveying another message. A virtuous and positive message. And if we have time, in fact, the four groups correspond to the four letters of God's name. The Yud, the He, and the Vav, and the He. We'll see if we can explain that. But what are these four groups now, on an altered state now? You see, dear friends, everything in Torah has endless layers. So even a story, which on the overt level is a negative one, let's say a story of the Jews worshipping a golden calf. And you read the text. And the Jews worshipped the golden calf, and they committed all kinds of terrible sins. Those very words, if you peel back layers and layers and layers and layers, is saying something extraordinarily positive. In fact, the positive dimension precedes the negative dimension. Torah precedes creation. The Torah existed before creation. The Torah as it is within God is divine. Except when it came down to the world, it plays itself out sometimes negatively and positively. But at the root of it, even the negative incident, story, curse, threat, whatever, is really, if you trace it back, it's initially a very profound, positive statement. He wrote the script before he did the movie. And the way the movie would play out depends on us. I'm getting to very, very profound, maybe even murky waters here, because it's not all that clear. You can ask a simple question. If the Torah was written before creation, then what choice did anybody have over here? The script was written. But the answer is, to simplify it somewhat, the words were written. But what those words mean depend on us. Those words could mean a profound accomplishment and an incredible blessing, or something in between, or something terrible. So that's the choices that we have. We're given these divine energies, which are all positive. What are you going to do with it? Is the question. And in fact, when something in Torah, as we see it, as it occurred, is negative, it means that the source is extremely high. That's why it's hard to channel it. It's hard to use properly. It's so powerful. When you're trying to go up a mountain and you're given this huge shove from behind, and so if you're supple, and you know how to use it, then it's an incredible lift. But if you're resistant, it cracks, breaks you. So these curses in Torah really are incredible opportunities. We didn't use them properly. And so we broke with it. We shattered. But ultimately, we're going to repair all of that. The Messianic era, the whole Torah remains. What about all those verses that are curses and promises of punishment? What are they going to mean in the Messianic era? Answer, then they're going to mean what they really meant. Then they're going to be revealed in terms of their source. Those very words are going to convey the most profound blessings. So, for example, one place And there's two sections of curses. One place it says you're going to go crazy from that which your eye sees. Vayisa meshuga mimara enayim. Simple meaning, crazed with hunger and crazed with... That's going to mean crazed with love with God, hunger for godliness and so on. The very same words can convey something negative or positive. That depends on us. God's promise is the end, it'll all become positive. Anyway, but the case in point here is that the four camps, which in our discussion till now, as profound as it was, they were all negative and dismissed by Moses. On a deeper level, they are in Torah, so on some level they're positive. And there are four levels in the service of God, corresponding to the four letters of God's name. And briefly, as we wrap things up, the first group that advocates casting into the sea represents self-sacrifice. Very lofty, virtuous level. I'm not talking anymore the suicide or the isolationists. We're going now, we're tracing this position to its Torah source. Self-sacrifice. The group that says go back to Egypt is talking about we have to exploit Egypt and use the power of Egypt and the gold of Egypt in the service of God. That's the going back to Egypt. The group that says fight is saying that there are times in their inner battle with self that we have to ignore our own protests. We have to be confrontational. At times you have to be confrontational with self. Okay, there's more to this, but truth is, to put it simpler, and maybe it's simpler to correspond to the four letters of God's name. The first group is the Yud. Yud is a quintessential point. Yud is self-surrender, self-sacrifice. That's the Yud. Hey, I'm going to gloss over this now because this requires a lot of background. But Hey corresponds to the faculty of Bina, which is analysis and development. Bina. So the second group is expressing our task to develop the world, going back to Egypt and develop it and use it and exploit it. Vav is the emotion. The second one's very intellectual. The first is self-sacrifice or will, if you want. Willpower that transcends intellect. That's the Yud. That's the into the sea. Complete bittul, submerge, disappear. Self-sacrifice. The second group, go back to Egypt, is the development of the world. That's another dimension of the service of God. Intellectual approach, the analysis. The third group is the emotion, corresponding to the six emotions. And that's the war. War is a kind of a very aggressive, emotional expression. That's serving God with love and awe. And the fourth group is prayer. The fourth group is, well, obviously they say prayer, but the fourth group is attachment to God. Prayer is when a person attaches himself to God from below to above. Anyway, that has to do with malchus. I'm not explaining this all, but you get the idea. Anyway, and I'll just list it. The first group talks about the virtue of self-sacrifice. The second one, the virtue of understanding. The third group, the virtue of emotion. And if you want the fourth group, the virtue of practice. Really, practice. Performance of mitzvahs. Which is symbolized by prayer. I know I'm not elaborating, but I just want to give you a sense that all these four groups, on a deeper level, are not dismissed, but are all part of a greater whole in the service of God. But at any rate, getting back to the basic message tonight. The basic message tonight is that the world is not the enemy. And we need to know that with certainty, so that we are joyous, we are positive, we are confident in the outcome. There is a godliness within all things. The world is just waiting to become God's garden. Just needs a little cultivation, and it'll yield incredible luscious fruits. And not surprisingly then, the opening discourse, or the final discourse of the previous Rebbe before he left this world, begins with the words, God says, this world is my garden. And that's in fact the opening words of the Rebbe's discourse as he accepted the mantle of leadership. He repeated that phrase and developed it. The world is God's garden. We need to develop it. Not run away and not conform and not fight it, and not ask for intervention. Develop it. Go ahead. Just do what you got to do. And that explains the song which they sing. Just for a minute, a word about the song itself. It's a funny kind of song. Read it. It's a funny song because... It's a funny song because you'd think... I mean, I'll give you 2 seconds to read the song. Give me 2 minutes. Just read it through. This up. The thing is like this. The thing is you'd expect the song to talk about how the Jews are saved. It doesn't talk much about the Jews. It talks about the Egyptians and then the Amorites and the Unites and the... You know what I'm talking about. The Canaanites, the Philistites... Yeah, why are we talking about everybody else except for the Jews here? What kind of song is this? The answer is that that's what they began to understand. That we've got to impact the world. And that the world's got to see and appreciate the special relationship God has with the Jewish people. That's what the world wants to see, believe it or not. They don't want apologies, apologetics. For being chosen. They want us to own up to it. And so the whole song talks about the way the non-Jews saw the whole thing. But here, admittedly, hang on a sec. Because, what's going on? Because that's the way it was then. I told you the Egyptians were a tough lot. And even after the 10 plagues, they still didn't get the message. Because it's still early on in the mission. The world still needs a bit of developing. So then, the world gets the message kind of forced on it over their head. But the final prophecy, where God will reign forever and ever, is referring to the final redemption, where the world's not going to be trembling or in dread or punished, but the world will be part of the celebration. So the Exodus and the crossing of the Red Sea begin a process. But we're going somewhere, and that is impacting the world. Initially, you impact the world by kind of forcing the message. And so they dread and they're afraid and they're scared. But slowly but surely, as we continue to proceed towards Sinai and the Promised Land and develop the world by doing the mitzvahs, the end is God's kingdom is established on earth for all peoples to be part of. But that's a detail. What I want to convey here is that the song talks about the way the world is affected by it. That's what Moses, don't be afraid of the world. They want to hear your message.